Greetings and welcome back to our ongoing series of the study of the Book of Esther. This is our ninth podcast, and we are now beginning the fourth chapter of the Book of Esther. My name is Yitzchak Etshalom, and I'm privileged and honored to be studying with you in anticipation of the upcoming holiday of Purim, by which date we hope to complete this year's study of Esther. We are now at the beginning of the fourth chapter, as I mentioned, and we have completed the scene in which Haman and Ahasuerus sat down to eat dinner, as it were, while the Jews throughout the kingdom, and specifically mentioned the Jews in the city of Shushan, are fasting and are weeping, etc. The first few verses in chapter 4 stress in a subtextual manner the tension felt by Mordechai, and indeed perhaps felt by other Jews in the city of Shushan, between their, shall we say, assimilated sense of identification with the rest of the citizenry and their unique identification as Jews. So let's read the first few psukim. Properly stated, this chapter is divisible into two halves, which are not equal halves. The first is the several verses describing Mordechai's behavior in the streets and Mordechai's interaction with the Jewish community, and the lion's share of the chapter, largely writ from verse 4 until verse 17, but more tightly from verse 7 through verse 16, are the interaction between Mordechai and Esther as he successfully gets the word of what's happening in Shushan and throughout the kingdom into the palace. As I mentioned, there seems to be an impregnable wall that separates the palace and what goes on inside from what's going on throughout the empire. Mordechai yada'at kol asher na'asah. Mordechai knew everything that had happened. This phrase is somewhat difficult, because if we are referring to the decree of Ahasuerus, remember it's Ahasuerus' name that appears as the signator, it is his seal, it is his order. If we are referring to the order and decree of Ahasuerus, well, that's something that everybody knows. So what is it that Mordechai knows more than others? We will see that forthwith. Mordechai yada'at kol asher na'asah. He knew everything that had happened. Vayikra Mordechai et begadav. His reaction was a reaction of mourning. He rent his clothes. Vayilbash sak va'efer. He put on sackcloth and ashes. This we have seen in earlier times in Tanakh, as a reaction to bad news, but not only in a Jewish environment, also the city of Nineveh, in chapter 3 of the book of Yonah. That's their reaction. Vayitzei betoch ha'ir. He went out throughout the city. Vayizaak ze'aka gedola umara. He let out a ferocious and loud cry, a bitter cry of mourning. Now, notice, he goes out into the streets of the city, and that is how he appears there. There is no overt mention, not here nor later on in the chapter, of prayer within the context of his behavior, and yet it seems to be alluded to, not as much here as later, and again, as I mentioned much earlier in the series, it seems to be deliberately censored out of the text for reasons that we'll talk about when we get to the end of the Megillah. And so he came walking that way until he got just before the palace gates. Why? Editor's note. Ki ein lavo al shar melech levush sak. He is inappropriate to come to the palace gates themselves wearing sackcloth. Now, this can be simply an editor's note. It can also be something of a charge leveled against Mordechai, in that Mordechai is willing to, in the streets of the city, where it's not a violation of protocol to walk around in sackcloth and ashes, but where it would be a full disclosure of the conundrum, of the terrible plight that he is in, and would be a challenge to court protocol, that he's not willing to do. And throughout the story, he plays by the rules. Right? It can be an observation. It could perhaps be a bit of a criticism. On the other hand, those who have argued that Megillat Esther's most significant contribution is that of a, as it's been called by one, a book of survival for the diaspora. This might indeed be the modus vivendi, is that you have to, as much as possible, play by the rules, and that includes court protocol. In any case, in every province, which some have argued a province means, Ibn Ezra claims that a province, the word Medina means a walled city. This becomes a little bit difficult in chapter 9. But in any case, in every province, anywhere where the king's word and his protocol, his rules, arrive, Avel gadol la Yehudim. There's great mourning for the Yehudim, for the Jews. Vitzom uvechi umispeid. And here we would expect an overt expression of religious pleading, of religious outcry, of prayer, of supplication. And it is again does not appear in our text. Fasting, bechi, crying, mispeid, which means mourning. The word mispeid in rabbinic and in modern Hebrew means a eulogy, but mispeid in Tanakh means mourning itself. Sak va'efer yutzal l'rabim. Sackcloth and ashes are being handed out to everyone. In other words, everyone's being given, these are Jews, you got to wear sackcloth and ashes, we're in a terrible state, this is what we wear. So now Mordechai, who is a member of the court, and is known as a member of the court, is walking around in the streets of Shushan wearing these clothes. Vatavona na'arot ester v'sariseha v'agidula. Now, what is it that the courtiers and the eunuchs who worked for Esther, what is it that they came and told her? They come and tell her all the Jews in Shushan are walking around like this? Perhaps. That doesn't seem to be indicated by what follows. Do they come and tell her your cousin Mordechai is walking around in sackcloth and ashes? Well, that doesn't seem to work because Esther, according to the report, had not yet told anyone of her relationship to Mordechai. So the easiest thing to posit here is that her courtiers came and mentioned there's a member of the court, a fellow by the name of Mordechai, who is walking around the streets wearing sackcloth and ashes. We'll see how that plays out. Vatitchalchal hamakamiyod. The best translation of this would be that she trembled. She greatly trembled. And she greatly trembled because internally she understands that Mordechai is doing this because some terrible thing has happened. She's aware that she has been insulated from what's going on, and therefore she really does not know what is going on outside of the palace gates. What is her reaction? Vaitishlach et bigadim habishet Mordechai laser sakom yalav. Volokibel. She sent garments to be put on Mordechai, and he refused them. And put these garments on and take the sackcloth off. Now, let's play out and see what happened. She obviously didn't go herself. It says she sent these clothes. She's not going to leave the palace. She sent these clothes. What did she send? What did she say to her agent? There's a fellow who's going out to the streets. Whoever it is, or a few people, he said, what did she say to them? Listen, that's my cousin, make sure that he has nice clothes on, tell him to shy still, he shouldn't make a ruckus, is that what she's saying? The simplest explanation is she shook up because she assumes that there's some personal problem. It happened to Mordechai, he's lost money, he's gone a little crazy, he had a fight with somebody, his clothes are torn, she doesn't know what's going on, but her first reaction is not to find out what's going on, but it's rather to have his clothes changed to proper clothes. Proper royal clothes. And how is she going to excuse this to the people she's sending if she doesn't allow them to know, if they do not yet know of her relationship with him? She'll have to say, listen, it's not nice that a member of the court, of the Achashverosh, is walking around like that. He must have had some problems. Send him some clothes in my name. That must be what happens. In the meantime, Mordechai refuses to accept these clothes. Now, Volokibel is exactly parallel to what happened in chapter 3 when all the other members of the court are telling Mordechai to bow down. And Voloshamalehim, he doesn't listen to them. Now, does that mean that Mordechai is obstinate? Not necessarily, but we are highlighting here that Mordechai's refusal to bow down to Haman and Mordechai's refusal to give up his clothes of mourning are, excuse the pun, of one cloth. They're made of one red line that Mordechai refuses to cross. And Mordechai, while he is ready to put on his proper clothes when he comes to the palace gates, he's not willing to give up his clothes in the morning in the streets. So now, so a particular fellow Hatach, who evidently Esther trusts more than others, Esther summons him. He's one of the eunuchs of the king that he placed in front of her. And again, in the context of the queen's court, we almost assuredly have to refer to Saris as really a eunuch and not just a servant. Vatetzavehu al Mordechai. She commanded Hatach to go to Mordechai. Ladat mazeh v'al mazeh. To find out what's what. Why are you wearing sackcloth? What's going on? She understands now that there's something deeper than just an incidental event in Mordechai's life. There's something greater. So he went out to Mordechai, a rechov ha'ir, asher lifnei shar ha'melech. So again, he went to the streets of the city, which is in front of the palace gates, meaning not at the palace gates. Mordechai will not come to the palace gates dressed like that. But on the other hand, Mordechai will not shed his sackcloth and ashes. So this Hatach goes out to find out what goes on. And now, from here till the end of the perek, we have a dialogue where Hatach is the middleman. Again, remember, this dialogue is not taking place in Hebrew, because at the very most, Hatach, at the very least, even if you want to assume that Esther and Mordechai, whenever they were together, would speak in Hebrew, which is a possibility, but not necessarily the case, the Jews throughout the empire at this point certainly were speaking Aramaic. And here are Jews who were born and raised in Shushan. But even if you would argue that they spoke Hebrew with each other, here you have a middleman who not only, there's no reason to think he knows the Hebrew, but he is not supposed to know about Esther's background as a Jew. So that means that we have a translation here. Pay attention to how the author translates. So from Pasuk Zion through Tet Zion, we have a dialogue made up of a speech of Mordechai and a response of Esther, a speech of Mordechai and a response of Esther. And oh, the amazing changes that take place over the course of this dialogue. So just as one little prefatory note, keep in mind, who is it who is controlling whom throughout the course of Esther's reign as queen, from the moment she became queen and even from the moment she entered the palace for preparations to be selected as a queen until this moment, it's quite clear that Mordechai, this relatively low member of the court, is controlling the queen of Persia. She doesn't do what Mordechai told her not to do. Mordechai told her to be silent. She's been silent. And inside the palace, she continues to maintain Mordechai's command. Watch how that changes. Now, Vayetzei Hatach el Mordechai, Rechov Ba'ir, Asher Lifnei Shar HaMelech. So he went out. Pasuk Zayin, verse 7. Vayagav el Mordechai et kol asher karahu. So Mordechai told him everything that happened to him, or everything that happened. Now this itself is a little strange, because there is nothing really beyond the document, which is there for everyone to see outside of the palace, that is critical information. After all, all that Mordechai has to let Esther know is that there's a decree that's been signed by the king to wipe out the Jews, and ask Esther to go in and please to have this decree changed, to have this decree rescinded. And yet Mordechai tells Hatach a story, and he tells him everything that happened, and then he tells him a most wondrous thing, which raises two very large questions. Ve'et parashat ha-kesef, the story about the money, or in modern Hebrew we refer to it as money gate. A parasha is a story, but the parasha is also, in modern Hebrew, would also be called a scandal. All right, parashat Watergate. So in the main thing, parashat HaKesef, money gate, the scandal with the money, the story with the money. And he tells Hatach the story about the money that Haman offered to give Achashverosh in order, and there's that word again, le'abed, to make the Jews disappear, as it were. Now, there's two huge questions about this. First of all, why is he telling the story of the money? The money is a non-starter. As we recall, Achashverosh turned down the money. The money was simply an offer made by Haman in order to get the king to believe that his meaning and his intent with this unnamed people was enslavement or something far less injurious, far more revocable, and far less blatant than genocide. However, Achashverosh turned down the money, so there's no money. Money doesn't exist. Second thing is, how does Mordechai know about this? So as I argued several times over the course of this series, both in the second chapter when Mordechai is hanging out near the palace, near the women's area to find out how Esther's doing, and also at the end of chapter 2 when Mordechai reveals the plot, finds out about the plot to kill the king, it is fairly clear that Mordechai has some eyes and ears inside the palace. And that's not new. We know that in the Persian court there was lots of intrigue and lots of informing going on. I already mentioned that the first chapter of Zechariah seems to allude to that with its description of the man and the dark among the myrtle trees, etc. So Mordechai evidently has some eyes and ears inside the palace, and they've informed him about the conversation between Haman and Ahasuerus and the bit about the money. But why is he sharing that with Hatach? We now know why he knows, and now we understand, back to Pasuk Aleph, when Mordechai had died, Kol Asher Nasa. In verse 1, it says Mordechai knew everything that happened. What's the everything? At that point, I asked, well, everything that there is to know is written down. What is there for him to know that's actually? The answer is he knows the background, the conversation between Haman and Ahasuerus. So now, Mordechai shares with Hatach this information. Why? Well, let's look at the next verse and we'll see. V'yet Patshegen. Patshegen is a copy. V'patshegen k'tav hadat, asher nitan mishushan lashmidam natan lo. He gave a copy of the decree to Hatach, the decree that was put out in Shushan, that was put out lehashmidam, to destroy them. And notice, there are two verbs used in these two verses. One is what Haman told the king, leabdam, and what is what's actually written, lehashmidam, to destroy them. Laharota tester lahagidla, in order to show them to Esther and to tell her. Lahagidla. So in other words, it's not just for Hatach's job to come in, show her the document, and say, Mordechai, I want you to do something about this, but also to tell her the story. Uletzavot aleha. Many translate lahagidla as connected to letzavot aleha. To tell her, commanding her to go into the king. That's not what's happening. Leharot et Esther ulahagidla. To show Esther and to tell her. In other words, show her the document. Tell her the story with Haman's conversation with Ahasuerus. The misleading word la'abdam. The fake offer of the money. And all of that is letzavot aleha, to command her, lavo el hamelch litchanin lo, to go to the king, to supplicate, to beg him, ulvakesh fanav alama, and to beg of Ahasuerus for her nation. Which means Mordechai is doing several things. The first thing, of course, that he's doing is informing Esther of what's going on. Second is he is now commanding her, as he commanded her before to be silent, he's now commanding her to speak. And third of all, in very contemporary jargon, he's waking up the sleeper. There's a sleeper we've had in the palace now for at least 5 years. And now it's time for her to wake up. Ulahagila al amma, about her nation, which means Mordechai is telling her to reveal her identity. Now, why is he giving her the information, the story, about the money and la'abdam? It seems that Ahasuerus is not only asking Esther, or telling Esther, commanding her, as the words say, to go into the king and to beg for the salvation of the nation and the sparing of the nation. He's also giving her the proper tools for defeating her enemies. Because let's face it, Esther has two enemies. There's Ahasuerus, whose name is all over this document, and there's Haman, who is the brains behind the document. And she has to defeat them. Now, how do you defeat two such enemies? And this is where our plot begins to unfold. What Mordechai has just demonstrated to Esther, through telling her and showing her, is that Haman lied to Ahasuerus. Haman is a traitor. Haman utilized his glib tongue and his sharp wit to get Ahasuerus to agree to do something which is not at all what Ahasuerus thought was going to happen. Ahasuerus agreed, some nation, le'abdam. In the meantime, Ahasuerus' name is written on a document that says la'hashmidam. That gives Esther already the entry into her victory, which will depend on her ability to now pit Haman against Ahasuerus, to reveal Haman for the traitor that he truly is already, and through that to have his evil plan defeated. But to do that, she's also going to have to properly play off of Ahasuerus' psychological weakness, as she will have to utilize Haman's psychological vulnerability in order to push them against each other. And we will see that play out through the fifth and seventh chapter, chiefly through the fifth chapter. Okay. Hatach came and he told Esther what Mordechai had said. Right? And then Esther told Hatach to go to Mordechai. And what did she say to tell him? Kol avdei hamelech, ve'am medinot hamelech. All of the servants of the king and all of the provinces of the king, Yodim, they all know. Asher kol ish v'insha she'evol hamelech lachatzer pimit asher lo yikare. That any man or woman who comes to the king, to the inner courtyard, who is not summoned, achat dato lahamit means that there is one rule, he dies. anyone who comes to the inner courtyard of the king. In other words, in the palace, there's an outer courtyard, a chatzer chitzonah. There's also an inner courtyard, and inside of that, there is the throne room, Beit HaMelech. And anyone who comes into the inner courtyard, which means that they want an audience with the king and they have not been summoned, they will die. The parallels between this and the structure of the Mikdash and the rules of the Mikdash is quite apparent. It's nearly transparent. Is that there is the Chatzer HaChitzonah, and this is, by the way, terms that Yechezkel uses, is contemporary, that Yechezkel uses in his description of the Mikdash in the chapter 40s, in that section in Yechezkel, that there's an outside courtyard, which is the Azarah, there's the inside, which is the Kodesh, and there's, of course, the throne room, which is the Kodesh Kodashim. And what's the rule? Anyone who comes in dies. In other words, even a Kohen Gadol who comes in on Yom Kippur without the proper Ketoret dies. Anyone who comes into the Mikdash, who is Tamei, who is impure, or is not a Kohen, Hazara Karev Yumat, the outsider, the non-Kohen who comes in, will die. However, notice what happens. In Ahasuerus's court, the same hard and fast law applies, which is, without exception, they all die, except Levad, Me'asher, Shidlo HaMelech, Shavita Zahav, V'chaya, except if the one, the king, raises scepter to, and then that person lives. In other words, there is a hard and fast law. You must not go in to see the king without being summoned. And in every case, you will, without exception, die, unless you don't. The king, if the king's mood swings in such a way that he favors you, the king determines that he wants you to come, then you don't die. And that is contrasted, of course, immediately with our understanding of the rules of the Mikdash, where the rules apply without exception. There is no favoritism of that sort. There is no caprice on the part of God where he says, well, you know, I like David HaMelech, so he's Yisrael, he's non-coin, but if he walks in, I'll excuse him. We don't have such a thing. And that distinction is very important. Now, that's not the end of her defense, of her explanation of why she doesn't want to accept this mission. I have not been summoned to the king for 30 days. Now remember, from the way that the Megillah describes Ahasuerus is not a king who spends every night with battle plans and spends every day in meetings with his officers. From the description of the Megillah, he's somebody who likes to party and likes women. And if Esther, who he previously had loved more than all of the others, has not been summoned for 30 days, we have to immediately assume that there is some other girl in who lies in his arms at night, and somebody else who he's spending his time with, which raises the specter again of Tachat Vashti. It raises, of course, the concern about, will Esther have any sort of in with the king? So Esther points out, I can't come to the king legally by the law of the court because I haven't been summoned, and I'm obviously out of favor with the king because it's 30 days since he summoned me. And by the way, that does paint a picture of the Persian court different than many other courts that we know from antiquity, in which the queen is something of an equal to the king. Here, the queen is a member of the court like everyone else, and it's only the king who is the quasi-deity, as it were. In any case, that is her presentation to Mordechai. Mordechai's response. Vayomer Mordechai l'Hashiva l'Esther. Here's his response. And this response, Vayigidu l'Mordechai et divrei Esther, verse 12, they told Mordechai Esther's words, and this presentation is presented in very structurally sound form. Hatach goes and presents the words of Esther to Mordechai, Mordechai's response to Esther, etc. Here's Mordechai's response to Esther. Vayigidu l'Mordechai et divrei Esther. Here's his response. Don't imagine for a moment, don't imagine in your heart, as it were, that you will be saved out of all the Jews because you're in the palace. In other words, Mordechai's position is that Esther's identity will become known. And if there is a decree to kill all the Jews, she's going to go with them. This is somewhat of a strange argument, considering that nobody really does know that Esther's Jewish. But in any case, this is the way that Mordechai frames it. That's his first argument to her, that she should go to the king, because after all, if she goes to the king and the king favors her, she's fine. If the king doesn't favor her, she's dead. But if she doesn't go to the king, she's dead anyways. Kim acharesh tacharishi ba'et hazot, because if you are silent at this time, Revach v'hatzalah yamod la'yudim makom acher. There will be salvation and space, as it were. Revach, meaning breathing space. There will be a salvation that will come to the Jews mim makom acher. That is a most strange statement. What is Mordechai claiming here? That there's some inherent genetic value that the Jews have, that they're able to survive? Are they on top of Darwin's chain of evolution, that they will somehow outlive all of their enemies? That may be the case, but why is that the case? Why is it the Jews, one way or the other, going to get saved? Why is it that Mordechai believes that there is a historic destiny to the Jewish people, that they are going to be here one way or the other, and one way or the other they're going to get saved? Some will die, some will be lost, but the Jewish people will go on. The obvious answer is God, but that's left out. He doesn't say that at all. And again, this cuts to the agenda, evidently, of the final editors of the Megillah, who, as I pointed out, are several generations later, as you could see at the end of chapter 9, to keep God and specific religious behavior out of the Megillah, perhaps, as Ibn Ezra argues, to keep the pagans from paganizing such a mention, or perhaps there's another agenda, and we'll get to that at the end of our study. In any case, those who want to argue that Makom is an allusion to God, because in rabbinic literature, in Tanaitic literature, Makom, as in Baruch HaMakom Baruch Hu, etc., or Makom Yerachem Etchem, that doesn't work because it's simply not ever used in Tanakh in that way. V'atu v'etavich tovedu, you and your father's household, which by the way means Mordechai saying me, you and me, will die. But again, he uses the tovedu as a very poignant turnaround on Haman's deliberate equivoque. Who knows? Perhaps this is why you became queen. In other words, Mordechai presents three arguments to Esther why she should go to the king. First of all, if you don't go to the king, you're dead. So if you go to the king, you might be dead. So the odds are militate in favor of going. Second of all, if you're silent, we're going to be saved in some other way. So you're either part of the solution or you're not. You can go down in history as part of the solution, or you can disappear. But either way, it's not as if we rely on you ultimately for salvation. But at this particular point, you can grab the opportunity and go, and perhaps be part of the solution, or not. But if you're not, then you're going to be dead. And the third thing is that perhaps this is why you became queen. Now, of course, there he's pointing to divine providence. He's pointing to God's hand. Why do you think it is that you, of all people, became queen? Maybe this is your moment. Maybe it's the moment for you to come forward. Well, these three arguments are successful. V'atomer Esther l'ashiva Mordechai. Esther now responds to Mordechai and says, Lech knos et kol ha-yehudim hanimtzi'im b'shushan. She says, go gather all the Jews in Shushan. V'tsumu alai. Fast on my behalf. And remember, this is happening either on the 13th or the 14th of Nisan, because the documents were sent down on the 13th of Nisan. There is no mention of any Jewish holidays, except for Purim, in Megillat Esther. But we are clearly talking about the days or day before Pesach. And she says, fast for me, v'al tochlu v'al tishtu shloshet yamim, laila v'yom. And don't eat or drink for three straight days. That's quite intense. Gamani v'narotai atzum ken. I and my maidens will do the same. I'm going to enforce my maidens to fast. I'm going to fast. We're all going to fast for 72 hours. And then I will come to the king without protocol, against the protocol. And if I am lost, I am lost. And again, using that particular word. There are many, many beautiful midrashim on this entire dialogue. And on that last pasuk, working on the midrash that Esther and Mordechai were married, and that this is the point at which she finally goes to Achashverosh willingly, so that destroys her relationship with Mordechai. All sorts of beautiful midrashim. Simple pshat here, what that's happening is Esther is saying, I'm going to come to the king against the protocol. If I die, I die, and you all have to fast on my behalf. Now, the obvious piece of her request for those 3 days, again, is missing, which is fast and pray. Prayer, again, is excised from the text at the beginning of chapter 4, at the end of chapter 4. God is, who is clearly the omnipresent one, throughout both Mordechai's declaration of what's going to happen and Esther's command of what shall happen, is again cut out. But that is what she commands Mordechai. Vayavor Mordechai, Vayas Kechol Asher Tzivta Alav Esther. And what happened? Mordechai went out and he did exactly what Esther commanded him. And notice how powerfully things have changed over these few verses. A few verses ago, Mordechai is commanding Esther. Mordechai is still in charge of Esther. He's telling her what to do. You be silent. You don't tell anybody what nation you are. She continues to follow his dictum and his dictate. And now in a few short psukim, Esther is commanding, and the text is very clear about that. Mordechai goes and does what Esther commanded him, in the same way mirroring the way Esther did what Mordechai commanded her. Why has that changed? Why is Esther now the commander? Why is Esther developed from, if you will, the meek cousin who in the palace is following Mordechai's commands to the full heroine of the story who steps forward and is directing the action? Simplest explanation is because she accepts the responsibility of who she is. She embraces her identity fully and accepts the dangers and the risks that are involved. And remember, this is a girl who's maybe 17, 18 years old at this time. And because she's been in the palace for 5 or 6 years, and she's ready to embrace that. And we will see how her brilliant plan brings to the ultimate ruination of Haman, the threatening of Achashverosh, and of course the salvation of Am Yisrael. Everyone should have a wonderful day.